Okay, well, you alluded right at the end there to what I think was inter-imperial rivalry. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing you didn't mention in your talk, Lenin's 1916 imperialism. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could draw some lessons from that text, its relevance. I know this is a really big debate going on right now, and it's even inadequate here, but if you could just sketch out what you think are the main points in that text that we can learn from today. Also, one further point. I know from my understanding of that text, too, you mentioned that Lenin writes in 1917 State and Revolution, and mentioned that his essential point in that text is that you want to smash the state, you don't want to keep it. My understanding was different, that he realized that monopoly capital and finance capital, whatever you want to call it, had essentially laid the foundation, ready-made for socialist parties to take over with the, you know, the founding of state banks and big cartels, that kind of thing, the nature of the state vis-a-vis capital had changed, and they wanted to keep it intact, not smash it.
Okay, the speaker goes is open.
I could try to answer that. So Paul has less work. Yeah, he's satisfied with my answer. On that last one, I think what Lenin was referring to is the economic basis. You know, because Marxism in general said capitalism creates the economic basis on which socialism becomes possible. But the contradiction in capitalism is you have that economic potential that's there, but it's being wasted by the way capitalism does things, which is for profit or for, you know, consolidating state power or, you know, for war and all of those other things. So what he was saying is that it's easier to democratically manage the economy if it's already in big units of production. We can have a general meeting of all the workers, you know, making trains or something, and then they can figure out how they're going to make the train. It's easier to organize the economy democratically, like on that basis, than it would be if it's all tiny little economic units spread out, you know, and people don't talk to each other, people don't know what everybody else is doing and all that. So we were trying to combine that production base with the workers' democracy, which he talks about later in the State of the Revolution. Just that question. The first one, I'm not sure about imperialism, that would be a whole other session just on imperialism.
Okay, Kevin?
One of the things I was a bit kind of interested in was your characterization of the split in 1903. The Bolsheviks said sort of the left wing splitting away from what was more right. And I find that a little bit problematic in that, I mean, there were certainly not all the Mensheviks, but there were some who had, I think, differences of opinions on some of the criticisms about the hierarchy. And I don't know if I would characterize that as a split between left and right. And I think that sort of, if you look at, I was just reading last night some of the works of Julius Martov, who, when he came back to Russia after the revolution, he had ended up splitting away from the Mensheviks, and they supported the whites. And he was relatively ignored by them. And then, but he had a very good critique, I think, of what the Bolsheviks were doing, particularly after October. And one of the first things he did come out with was, in 1919, he came out with an article, and this has just been, I think, translated in English in the last 4 or 5 years. And it was a very good critique of the reimposition of the death penalty. And he was saying that, you know, if we're starting a new how are we being any different from Bizarre if we haven't got them? One of the other things that he was very critical of was, I think, hierarchy come above. And he had arguments dating back to 1903 with Lenin about that. And they made up, and you know, various times had, they did work on the Iskra together between that period after 1903, I mean, after 1905. One of the things that really got him in trouble was his criticism of what Lenin was doing with imposing collectivization on people. And Lenin ended up having to implement a new economic program and abandon somewhat collectivization, allow for limited selling of private small plots, which led to a massive increase in food production. But one of the things that I think maybe Lenin wasn't so good at talking to peasants. He spent a lot of time talking to, you know, revolutionary friends in Switzerland, Germany, wherever he was, Finland. And when he comes to the big chance, he seems to me that he, didn't really do a good job of explaining collectivization to the people. He alienated a lot of their support. And it wasn't until they allowed for the NEP that they actually were able to again take over and beat their opposition. And I do think that it was quite important that, you know, in 1920 he forced Martov to leave Russia, exiled him. And that I just think is kind of gross that a man who, you know, his own colleague and stuff, who's, I think, had some very good structural criticism of what was going on, that Lenin couldn't take it. The Bolsheviks forced him on top of the dawn.
The thing that I thought was interesting is that there's this tendency, I think, to conflate the idea of hierarchy with the idea of centralization. So I actually don't think those things are synonymous at all. I think centralization just means that you have kind of a focus. That's what it means to me anyway, that there's a focus that people democratically decide what the focus is going to be. But it doesn't mean hierarchy. Hierarchy to me means somebody else making the decision, and there's no accountability and there's no discussion and there's no consultation. That's hierarchy. So I think those two terms actually mean two different things. And that's it's tied to something else, but maybe I'll just leave it at that for now.
Doug?
Okay. I think what I got out of that talk, what came across, and from my previous understanding of Lenin, is that every time he's writing something, he's always... he's sort of going to the extreme to push his point. And so in a latter period, like the thing you said about 1903, he says we need professional revolutionaries. And then 1905, he says we need an open party where everything is elected. But he's always pushing it so far. If things are so far in one direction, he pushes all the way in the other direction to get something in the middle where it's right. And that's my interpretation of, like, if you're going to read Lenin, you actually have to understand the circumstances in which he's writing. And I've always found when I'm, you know, discussing Lenin with people is that everything, tons of stuff that he writes can be, they sound horrible if they're taken out of context. And maybe some of them were pretty, you know, maybe he wasn't very poetic when he said it. But I think that it's sort of an example, actually, if we're actually going to analyze Lenin and the Bolshevik Party and the Russian Revolution, and we're, you know, we call ourselves Marxists, we actually have to use the Marxist method of analyzing history, which I used the Marx's quote, which is people make their own history, but not in circumstances of their own choosing. And that's exactly how we have to analyze not only Lenin, but the Bolshevik Party as well, and any other organization or whatever that was in that revolution. So,
I could just add to that. I agree with that very strongly, and just reiterate, stress the point that Lenin's writings, especially around the turn of the century, are very political. He didn't write anything which wasn't without a political purpose. You know, everything had a purpose. It wasn't scholarly. It was polemical often, really, really, maybe a little rhetorical, maybe overly so. And one can't be misled by that. I mean, you mentioned Martov, and what is to be done? What is to be done, by the way, is, as Neil Harding has said, who I think is a really good scholar, knows what he's talking about on this, calls it the most misunderstood text in all of his corpus, exciting more ill-informed commentary than any other text. And that's so true if anybody who's dipped their toes into Leninology. So ridiculous and over the top. So what is to be done? Martov, all of Lenin's associates didn't have a peep, didn't say a word, not one objection to that text when it was published. In fact, it was the editorial, it was endorsed editorial by Iskra. It was the founding statement, more or less. It only happened, the conflict around that text comes in the split in the party. And it's more of a pretense than anything else. And then in 1906 or 1907, I'm not too quite sure, there's a reconciliation in which Martov comes back around to that text and endorses it again. That whole argument is totally bogus, totally bogus. And I'd also like to agree with Jessica's point about hierarchy versus centralization. The common term, I think that's what Paul mentioned, that being institutionalized. You can't universalize tactics. It's just not possible. It has to be homegrown. And one last point, just we have to distinguish between Lenin, historical Lenin, and I'd say maybe Leninism, and the what we know as Leninism, and what we know it, and where we know it from. We know it from the kind of the 60s Marxoid cults that grew up, popped up, in the, inspired by the Comintern and controlled by North Moscow, that kind of thing. That's not what he had in mind.
Then on.
Already?
Yeah.
There's someone who hasn't spoken yet. The way I see Lenin, and maybe people want to read stuff and read Lukács on Lenin. For me, Lukács' book about Lenin's thought, Lenin, and I'm seeing in the Unity of the Thoughts, something like that. It's very, very useful for me because what he explained in that book is that basically what's specific about Lenin, what he knew about Lenin if you compare to other socialist thinkers or socialist leaders that were before Lenin, is that he sees the question of the revolution as a practical problem, not as a theoretical abstract notion that something that's going to happen someday, some kind of a long, faraway dream. He was seeing the revolution as a practical problem, and that was because of Tsarism. Because Russia desperately needed a revolution of some sort to get rid of the Tsar and the brutal dictatorship that was going on there. So that it's Russia, I don't remember who said that, but they said that it's not Lenin who created the Bolshevik Party who then created the revolution. It's the other way around. The Russian Revolution created the Bolshevik Party, and the Bolshevik Party made Lenin. Because he was constantly immersed in organizing that party. About what is to be done, yeah, it's polemic, as you were saying. A lot of what Lenin writes is polemic against other ideas that are around, you know, at the time. What is to be done is a polemic against two views. One is the economists who are saying we should just immerse ourselves in the day-to-day struggles of the working class, and the revolution will come out of that. It should just be union organizing, you know, and no politics. And so he was polemicizing against that, saying, no, no, if you just do workplace stuff and union stuff, you're a reformist. The revolutionary is the one who defends the Jews when they're being attacked in the workplace, the one who defends the students who are being repressed by the government. It's the politics that, you know, have to be prevalent. The other group he was arguing against were the legal Marxist, you know, group, who were trying to find a way to basically spin Marxism or, you know, repackage it in a way that would be acceptable to the censors, you know, that would go through state censorship and be acceptable to the ruling class. And obviously what Lenin responded to that is, if you turn Marxism into something that's acceptable for the Russian ruling class, it's not going to be Marxism anymore. So that's basically it. That's what's to be done, I think, in a nutshell. So what was left was, we have to work as a clandestine organization. We can't change our ideas in order to become legal. That's nonsense. But on the other hand, we can't scrap our political project, which is get rid of Tsarism, to, you know, all of those things, and hide in workplace stuff. And both of those things have in common of abandoning the project of building a socialist party.
Brenda. Okay. I might be giving a little piece of history.
Go ahead.
Well, we know a lot now about what Lenin has said. I guess I'm wondering more about what actually happened, what did he actually do. There's been some talk about collectivization. And actually, there's one point I want to make right away, is that at least I believe, I think, yes, there's a difference between centralization and hierarchy, in theory, but often not in practice. And I think that's a really, really important thing to make, and or point to make. I don't know a whole lot about Russian history, and I don't know a whole lot about Lenin, but I'm wondering how collectivization occurred, why it was something that was seen as not being very well explained. I want to make a distinction between how do you explain this process, or how do you ask people about this process and ask them to tell you what they need. I guess in the back of my mind this entire time I'm thinking about the history of Tanzania and socialism there, and how collectivization was a major problem, actually, and really disrupted a lot of people's daily lives, their livelihood, their subsistence practices, and really wasn't very good for the population.
I kind of want to bust open the can of worms on Lenin to Stalin, because you analyzed what Lenin did more or less leading up to, you know, and including the Civil War, but what really didn't come across, I don't think, is the you did mention the horrible context in which the USSR emerged out of the Civil War, but from my understanding, that was the context in which you've got a single party that is struggling to try and make this skeleton of a worker state survive, and this is where, you start having top-down management of the economy, and where bureaucrats being appointed start becoming this clique, and what I would understand to be eventually a new ruling class. I was wondering just briefly how, if you could just mention how the hell did Stalin actually, not, you know, we can say, oh, he got the power through killing people, but how did he become the general secretary of the Communist Party, when my understanding is, and, you know, once in a while, he, like, before the revolution, he was robbing banks to fund the Bolshevik Party. And for my, and so, you know, this party after the Civil War was, my understanding was completely undemocratic, whereas before Lenin within the party was actually losing debates. Like, he'd make his point and people would vote against him, and just the whole, from my understanding, so Stalin gets in power, and basically there's this great line from a British socialist comedian who basically says, there seems to be some, Adrian knows this, is that there seems to be a difference of opinion. He says the fact that Stalin had all of the old Bolsheviks shot seems to indicate some difference of opinion. And so I just wanted to figure, like, how, you know, why wasn't Lenin leading the charge against Stalin? I mean, he seems to be leading the charge in the right direction until Stalin, you know, gets in power.
Okay, well, I guess Kevin, and then I'm Jess. And then, does anybody else want to speak
at
this? Benoit?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I'll going to say Doug, too?
I'll need 4 hours to wrap up.
Yeah. I was going to say, maybe we'll let Paul come up after. Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
I just wanted to make a quick clarification. When I didn't mean, sorry, forced collectivization during the Civil War and its requisitioning of the cross, because... and which wasn't anywhere near the same as collectivization. What happened under the NDP was they allowed a certain amount of the farmers to keep a certain amount of their crop, and then a little bit to be sold, and that based on the location of the farm. You had a certain area that was your own, and the rest was for the war effort or whatever. But it's not the same as collectivization, which I can't understand.
Okay.
The point I wanted to make.
Oh, yeah, well, I was going to say something similar. So instead, I'll just say that if anybody wants to come to the market, we're organizing carpooling from here. It's very inexpensive. You'll notice that the early registration deadline is Monday, or actually Sunday. Well, Monday. Yeah, cause either before April 11th or after April 11th. So I guess Monday is kind of the day. You can, it's very easy, it's very cheap. You can put down a deposit, you can put down a postage check, whatever, and we'll organize the transportation. And if you register by Monday, accommodation, you can get free accommodation. You can be billeted by someone in Toronto. So, and we always go to Mike's place after our forums for further discussion. And I'm sure that some people who didn't speak during the discussion had questions and might be interested in following up less formally, so please feel free to join us. Okay, Paul?
Well, I'd like to first thank everyone for your very good points, questions, comments. There's no shortcut. We have to debate and argue and study, and that's just an important part of it. Where do I start? I think this wasn't. It's important to situate everything in terms of its historical context. And that's easier to say than to do, particularly with something as complex as the Russian Revolution. The context in which the Russian Revolution happened is so different from the context in which we operate in Canada. A country of 140 million people, most of whom are peasants, maybe only 10 million of whom were urban workers, maybe only 3 million of whom would really classify as wage workers. I mean, that's the context. Most of the people who joined the Bolshevik Party were illiterate, and publications had to be read back and forth to them. You know, the context of World War, where millions of people were chewed up in those trenches. This is, I want to put that in context. The impact of the Civil War. Maybe I'll start with the issue of requisitioning, because until you have a sense of that context, you can't understand it. In principle, everyone is opposed to it, including the Bolsheviks. But the fact is that the cities were starving. The context of the Civil War is that without getting grain into the cities, and with the collapse of the economy, there was no money to trade for the grain.
And the peasantry had won its revolution. The peasants' revolution was to seize the land of the landlords, which the Bolsheviks supported. There were three slogans of the revolution: bread, peace, and land. And they supported the seizure of the land, but there was no money left because of the blockade, the civil war, the starvation, all the things I outlined. And the cities were literally starving. There's an incredible, essay on this called In Defense of October by John Rees in the journal that comes out of Britain, the International Socialism Journal. And he simply reprints telegrams that were being sent to the Bolsheviks from cities saying, we have 3 days of grain left. We have 2 days of grain left. Comrades, we have no grain left. Comrades, we've had a week with no food. We've had 2 weeks with no food. And silence. And this is the context in which the cities were literally starving. And the normal operations of we'll pay you money for your grain didn't make any sense. The money was worthless. They printed literally quadrillions of rubles. The money had collapsed. They requisitioned grain. They took the grain from some. They would give them a chit of paper saying, here, we're taking X number. Well, here. And it was worthless, the piece. We'll owe you. And it didn't mean anything. A whole series of things happened in the post-revolutionary. The Trotsky used the phrase tragic necessity. And I think that's an important thing to always... That's not to excuse everything. And we should always ask the questions. We should look, probe deeply into it. But the tragic necessity of many of these things was very, very real. In terms of Lenin to Stalin, that goes... what do we say about that? The necessity imposed itself in an even greater way. Lenin, when the Bolsheviks took power, think of that poor country. Think of a country that impoverished. They said, we can hold on to power for a time. But unless we get aid from a worker state in an advanced country, we will go under. They celebrated when they got to day 72. Whatever day it was, they said, now we've gone longer than the Paris Commune. Because that was the other worker state. They had no idea how long they would last. They didn't know it would last at all. It was a desperate situation. And at every moment where it looked as if the workers' revolution elsewhere would come to their aid, there was an explosion of, you know, I talked about the period 1922 when there was a decline in the Soviets. 1923, when the German workers almost took power. Thousands of workers took... Okay, we get 1919 when the German workers almost took power. You know, Karl Radek writes, I could hear the triumph of revolution in the streets. Hundreds of thousands of workers take to the streets. We're going to be... The German workers are going to come to our aid. It's defeated. 1926-27, when the Chinese workers seize the cities of China, and there's looks like it's going to revolution in China. Now, China would not be able to give much aid to Russia, because China is a very poor country itself. However, it would begin to break the encirclement of Russia. At that moment, and... There's a big fight going on between Trotsky and Stalin. Trotsky is extremely isolated, but for a moment in 1927, there's a wonderful book on this by Reitzman, I think his name is. He says, the rivers of the opposition grew like a flood as people flowed into the left opposition opposing the rise of Stalin. But the Chinese Revolution was defeated. And in the desperate circumstances where most of the people has to be destroyed, it's impossible to sustain political activity of the type we're talking about for very long when your belly is empty. And when you have to go to the countryside to dig potatoes, when your family is starving, in that context, Stalin emerges as an expression of the despair of the revolution. And I believe you have to see it as what's the one of the founding ideas of who we are in the International Socialists, putting on this meeting, is that it was a counter-revolution. That Stalin's consolidation of power by 1928-29 was a counter-revolution that... that completely destroyed the gains that had been won in 1917-1918. In the 1920s, it hung in the balance. In the 1920s, there were problems, deep problems. I've tried to outline. I don't want to try to cover them over. They made concessions that no socialist would want to make. I think the conditions were the most overwhelming part. But they were holding on. It was a holding operation. They held on remarkably for 11 years. But they couldn't hold on forever, and then there was a counter-revolution. Understanding that goes back to... I'll come back to that at the end. Okay, let's deal with some... Centralism and hierarchy. This is a very important thing. First of all, there are moments when it is absolutely right to organize hierarchically. The Iraqi resistance is, without any question, right now organizing hierarchically, and they are right to do so. They're in an underground military struggle against American imperialism. There is no possibility of open democratic debate and discussion about tactics. You have to actually act very quickly, very secretly, otherwise you get shot and killed by an absolutely brutal occupying regime. Guerrilla struggles are necessarily not always hierarchical. There's moments of incredible democracy you can see in
I won't go into the Eritrean struggling in for independence in Ethiopia. There's some moments of incredible democracy inside the resistance movement, but there's many occasions when there's a military struggle. The hierarchy is inevitable. It's imposed on the situation. But centralism, will centralism inevitably... does centralism inevitably lead to hierarchy? I think Jessica's point is very well taken in that. It's, you know, it depends how you mean by centralism. The International Socialists, we're centralist. What does that mean for us? It means we put out the same, we all sell the same paper across the country. You know, it means that we meet 4 times a year and we organize it with, we strain our resources 4 times a year to get together in Toronto to discuss the key issues of the day and try to work out a common understanding as close as we can of what the key issues are. And so we work towards it. Recently that's been Iraq. We think that the situation in Iraq is the key issue around which we have to organize. And there's been some discussions about that, etc. That's really all it means for a group like ourselves. That's the extent of centralism. It's pretty minimal. And the rest is the emphasis on the democracy, the self-activity, the local organization, because without implementing that stuff, it doesn't mean anything. I think that what Lenin was writing about in 1906, the reason I think that this quote from the 1906 Congress is so important is because he was aware of the fact that it can be a tendency inside any organization. Any organization is inherently conservative in a certain sense. There's a conservatism inside you get used to doing things the same way. He says we have to always be pushing against that. Push down as deep as you can into the organization. Push down into the class. Autonomy for the local units, elected principal for the people involved, etc., because there always has to be a conscious fight for democracy inside. That's why it's democratic centralism. I suppose the other way around it should be called centralist democracy. So, I think that that's an important... this isn't a proof of it, but I think that's the way I would try to deal with it. Okay, some of the other points. I won't have time to deal with the issue of imperialism. It's an extremely important debate. In terms of smashing the state, I think that Benoit who addressed that? Yes. There's the state, the politically coercive apparatus of the state, which is an important, has to be smashed. The CSIS, all the rest of it, CSIS, the RCP, the Supreme Court, the Army, it has to go. There are administrative ends of things that we will take over and use in better and different ways, etc. And there's an administrative end of things that is different. I think that's a point worth taking. Okay. The point about what is to be done. I'm glad that it was raised. It's a beautiful book, actually. There are some awful statements in it. All of them are by Karl Kautsky. All of them. Now, Karl Kautsky, who was the great theorist of German social democracy, Lenin quoting Karl Kautsky, the most extreme statements about socialism only comes to the working class from the outside. That's Karl Kautsky. It's Lenin quoting Karl Kautsky. What is better is usually called elitist. It's an elitist book. It's an elitist top-down stuff. It's imbued with the utmost respect for the working class. He talks about we need a workers' organization, but it's very difficult. He's describing what a professional revolutionary is. He says, but it's very difficult for workers to actually deal with the political aspects of things because they're working 12 hours a day in the factory. Liberate them from the factory. Pay their salaries from the party. Make them a professional revolutionary. They can be the core of the party. This is not elitist. This is a sense of the profoundest respect for the working class, pulling them into the whole thing of the organization. Martov, I don't think he was expelled from Russia. I think he went to Europe because he was getting treatment for tuberculosis. It's open to debate. But I do know that Lenin and the Bolsheviks sent one of their best doctors to Europe to help him out. I mean, Lenin's relationship to Martov, once again, is one thing I'm not going to have time to get into, but it's something that I think that there's some dispute over that. Let me not deal with the personal relationship between Lenin and Martov. Let's get to the issue of the relationship between Bolsheviks and the other currents. Martov was a left Menshevik. There is no question that the party, which was at the center of the revolution in October of 1917, was not just Lenin's Bolshevik party. It was a party that was new. It grew from 20,000 in February to 400,000 by October 1917. Its core was the Bolsheviks, but it brought on board Trotsky's group, the Mezhuryanstvo, the Interdistrict Committee, who were basically intellectuals without a party, without the workers. It brought aboard many of the left Mensheviks. And Trotsky's group was better than the Bolsheviks at certain things. Trotsky's group had a better understanding of the nature of the revolution. They knew it would be a workers' revolution. I don't have time to go into that, etc. The left Mensheviks who came over were better at the Bolsheviks than some things. The left Mensheviks had a better sense of the dynamics of the movement earlier on than the Bolsheviks. They responded to the women in February 1917 who were saying, we're going to go. The Bolsheviks held back. The Mensheviks, the left Mensheviks, responded and said, no, we're with you. We're going to go. We think this can be a revolution. So they all came together into one organization, which later changed its name to the Communist Party because it was no longer really the Bolshevik Party. And some anarchists, many, Alfred Rosberg, Victor Serge, a whole section of anarchists came over and identified themselves with the revolutionary process. At a party of 400,000 workers in a country where there are only 3 million workers, think of that. I mean, this is a huge, in a certain sense, the class and the party begin to fuse in a very, very real sense of the revolution. But, all that being said, it's without the work of the Bolshevik Party, it wouldn't have happened. They were all necessary components, but the indispensable component was the one that Lenin had built. Had that one not been built, then the other ones would not have been able, I don't think, to have led the revolution. I should stop very soon. Okay. Mixing up the essentials with the contingent, maybe I'll end there. There were 2 points. I haven't dealt with all the points, have I? NEP. I don't know if I've missed them. This was a very rich discussion. There was lots of points raised, and if I've missed some, I didn't mean to. It's because there's a lot of things on the table we can do with it at Mike's place. I think that I want to come back to. I think that there was a huge. I'll do it in reverse order. The issue of the state, the issue of the party. I think that the left in the 20th century tragically mixed up the essential and the contingent in understanding Russia. Russia took the form of state capitalism in the 20s, and Lenin used this term, and that was a tragic necessity because of the way in which the working class had been gutted by the whole experience, and it was a holding operation, a desperate holding operation, to try to keep things together, hoping for aid for the world revolution. Most of the left in the 20th century assumed that that was socialism, that state capitalism was the same thing as socialism. Nonsense. Completely wrong. Go back to read State and Revolution, study the earlier Russian Revolution, that's what socialism is. It's from below. It's the working class and the peasantry and the poor emerging as actors in their own right onto the stage of history with their own institutions, with their own, putting their own imprint of things. That, I think, has been a huge issue for the left. The second one is in terms of how we organize. Mixing up the essential with the contingent means that sometimes, I don't want to use any examples, but you'll know who I'm talking about, who I call the toy Bolsheviks, who've read a little bit of Lenin and think that now we're the Bolshevik Party and we're going to... And it's appalling. And it's pretentious. It's the leftist sects from the 60s and the 70s that are just... that put themselves outside the struggle with this, we're the centralist professional revolutionary organization that's going to lead the revolution. It's ridiculous. It's boring. It's pretentious. If we get the essence of it, then we can do something very, very, very exciting. The essence of it is a very simple idea. We're very left-wing. We know that this system will require a revolution. It will require one. We will not get to socialism without a revolution. The study of history shows us this very clearly. This is a brutal capitalist class with a state apparatus that will use. However, knowing that does not mean that we have to go to the corner and say, join the Revolutionary Party right now because the revolution is, you know, the only way to go. We can go to the corner and say, support the war resisters. We can go to the corner and say, it's time to stop the war in Iraq. As we go to the corner and say, get Canada out of Haiti right now, because the occupation of Haiti is being in a peacekeeping guise. It's actually not peaceful. We can, etc. You get the point. We can. The Bolshevik practice was to pull those two things together and say, as we do our daily work in fighting for these reforms, we train people in the necessity of revolution, all the things that we link the two things together. That's the essential thing. And if we do that, and I think that now is a very exciting moment, has opened up in world history in the last four or five years, the possibility of building an organization that combines those things is A, very exciting, very possible, very real, and B, very necessary, because that is the organization that we're going to have to build over our lifetime to deal with the hungry, profit-driven, greedy, bloody monster that is world capitalism that has to be overcome. So come to Mike's place and join the IS. There you go.